In May 1985, after a long standoff, police dropped a satchel full of explosives on top of a row house in Philadelphia.
All the men came down?
That's when a big bomb went off. It shook the whole house up.
Lisa, there has just been a huge explosion here. We don't know what it means, but it just shook the whole place. Debris flew all over the place. I don't know what that explosion was. All I can tell you is that it was a huge blast.
Get a shot with me.
Harvey, can you hear us?
At this point, I really can't tell you very much. There was about a 15-second delay, then an explosion.
Perhaps the most frightening thing here is that police do say that 6 to 8 children are believed to be inside the move house.
As soon as we find out what the explosion is, we will try to tell you. At this point, I simply do not know.
The move house on Osage Avenue was where a confrontation with police stretched out over hours and days. Thousands of rounds of ammunition were fired. Eventually, 11 people died. In a new documentary, Let the Fire Burn, director Jason Osder uses archival footage to retell the story of MOVE, its relationship with the Philadelphia police, and that standoff. The film played in the Best of Fest yesterday showing at the AFI Docs Festival just outside of Washington. Jason Osder joins us here in Studio 42. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
What drew you to this moment in history?
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I was growing up in Philadelphia at the time, and I was, 5 children and 6 adults were killed in the fire. And I was roughly the age of some of the children, and I think a combination of just how shocking the events were, but also the timing in my life that I was roughly that age, and also that, I think those of us that are lucky to have sort of traditional childhoods, we grow up sheltered in a certain way. And for most people, there's a moment where that shelter is broken. And my parents' generation will always remember where they were when JFK died. But for me, it was the MOVE fire. And again, being a child, I think I lacked the context and the frames that adults might put on it. And to me, I was just really frightened.
Almost 30 years later, it seems impossible that the police department drop a bomb on its own city.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, making the film and thinking about what it means, that's sort of the most essential question that the story provokes, is sort of how does the unthinkable come to be reality. And I tried to really draw that out in terms of the moral in the film.
Even more unthinkable is the question raised by the title of the movie. We see the mayor, Wilson Good, saying a decision was made to let the fire burn.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's a very complex story. And at a certain point, I think that events on the police side become driven by fear mostly. There's a previous confrontation where a police officer is shot 8 years previous, and there's still a lot of overlap on the force with individuals that remember that. And the group has constructed a very intimidating structure on their roof that becomes known as the bunker. And it's fortified, and it has holes to shoot out of, and they have high ground on the block. And the police come to believe, come to feel that they are in real danger.
And that is only after their initial tactics failed. These were improvisations.
Yeah, I think in the days leading up to the confrontation, one of the things you see is a reluctance on the part of the police organization for people higher up in the organization to participate in the planning because, there would be plausible deniability. So then as things go bad, it becomes more and more haphazard and truly spirals out of control.
There are miscalculations on the other side, too. This is a group that had its intentions, but one of the things it was doing was deliberately provoking the people in that neighborhood so to force the police department to make a decision.
Yeah, I think that's accurate, and it's difficult to know at the end of the day how far they wanted to take things. I think that there's a certain point of view that says, in fact, they wanted to provoke the action of the police and show the true nature of the system as they came over the top. Did they expect them to come over the top just that violently? Did they intend to die in the house? I don't know the answer to that. It's not impossible that, in fact, they did.
And they certainly provoked the neighborhood.
Absolutely. That was one of their tactics. After the initial incident in 1978, there were 9 members of the group imprisoned. And when they regrouped, they were advocating on behalf of those people. And their technique to advocate was that if they riled the neighborhood up, that they wouldn't get attention on their own. But if they drew the neighborhood into the conflict, the neighbors would bring the attention of the authorities. And it still took a long time and a lot of aggravation on the part of those neighbors. But again, in fact, they did force the city's hand to act.
And what did you come to understand about the nature of this group? And just going back, remembering at the time, they were sometimes characterized as a radical black organization, sort of a spin-off of the Black Panthers. And we did see pictures of them holding weapons at various points. They were portrayed as a back-to-nature group that fed the children only raw vegetables. They were also portrayed as a religious cult.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of things in play, and there are some patterns that we're familiar with and we can apply, and some things that are unique and different. I think for one thing, it did change over time. Back to nature seemed a fairly apt description in the early 70s when they started, but things became gradually more militant. I think the connections to actual Black Power movements are tenuous at best. I think that the sort of symbology of some of those movements and the imagery of black men holding guns, for instance, was...
And women.
And women, that's right. I think that imagery was used by the group to, again, provoke an action, whereas their intentions were different than a black liberation group. And in fact, pretty much all of those descriptions the group would reject. They would reject back to nature as well as black liberation. So I think some of these things apply. But then at the end of the day, especially as I made the film and I wanted to really bring in the point of view of Michael Ward, the only child who survived, and again, myself being a child at the time, there was also the sense that they were a family. And when you hear it from a child's point of view, you know, as different as they were, sometimes they were the same. And the sense in which they had these religious or quasi-religious beliefs, raw food. But the children always had to eat raw food, whereas the adults, not always. And to me, that doesn't sound that different than the way a lot of Americans take their religion. And when Michael Ward says in the film, you know, they didn't believe in spankings, they didn't hit us, but they would yell at us. And he's asked, well, did you cry when they yelled at you? And he said, yeah, we cried when they yelled at us. So in some ways, I wanted to keep intact that if you were, you know, regular is what you grow up with. And if you grow up in it, the rules were just the rules. And they were all the things we talk about, but they're also a family.
I was intrigued by the choice you made to use only archival footage in this picture. We see a lot of local television coverage. We see a lot of footage from the deposition of that young man you were just talking about. And we see a lot of footage from a hearing that was held about, 5 months after the incident to try to find out what happened, what went wrong, how all these miscalculations ended up in tragedy.
Yeah, I mean, I have to give credit to the editor of the film named Nels Bangeter, who's a very talented documentary film editor. And what he helped me realize when he came onto the project, I've been researching it a very long time. I had shot some interviews and intended to use them. But there was a combination of realizing that in those hearings, we had a tremendous potential to do something different and unique. And that, in fact, the things that you want to do with a documentary interview were not that strong in the interviews we'd shot. They weren't that revealing. People hadn't learned a whole lot. They hadn't changed a whole lot.
Because did you get a chance to talk with Mayor Good or former Mayor Good?
Mayor Good is the one interview that I wanted and I had not gotten at the time that we decided to go another direction. But I did interview Michael Ward, which is a big exclusive as an adult, as well as Ramona Africa and James Berghauer, one of the police that you meet in the film. And
about the only person who comes off really as a hero.
Yes, there is the feeling that James Berghauer is one police officer who is on the scene and sees the situation for what it is, which is children in peril. Whereas I imagine a lot of the other police officers sort of rooted in their boots.
I wanted to talk about that moment. There's we talked about that hearing, the commission where MOVE members, police, local government officials testify about the incident. And here's the Reverend Paul Washington asking police officers what they thought was going on when children left the house, then with facing the possibility of a, not the possibility, the actuality of a maelstrom of a terrible fire behind them, decided to go back inside.
Just as a human being myself, I'm just trying to imagine myself in that situation. And behind me, there's a raging inferno. And in front of me, there are people who are saying, come on out. I'm trying to imagine what would cause me to turn back and run into the fire.
A question, one of the many questions in the film, that's never answered.
Yeah, what happens at the culmination of the film in the back alley while the house is still on fire is sort of one of the great mysteries of the story for those who follow it. And we tried to leave things in the film with implications open. It's a little bit of a Rashomon moment. And yeah, I think people should watch and judge for themselves who's telling the truth and who's lying and what might have really happened in that back alley.
Jason Osger's new documentary is called Let the Fire Burn. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I have to say, you said a lot of the people you spoke with years later had not learned. There is an aspect of this that suggests we didn't learn either, because you look at this and you say, oh my God, Waco.
Yeah, it's a difficult story, and I think that in one sense it falls under the category of we might not have learned and we don't even know. One of the things as I grew older that was disturbing to me is as I, you know, left the Philadelphia area and grew up a little bit, met my peers from other parts of the country, just how unfamiliar people were of the story. And that goes on certainly with younger people as well. And I teach college now, and you know, for the most part, people have not heard of it. So, yeah, I think the beginning of, you know, it may be a cliche, but you can only, you know, we need to learn our history so that we don't repeat it. And I think even at a baseline level, it needs to be part of American history to learn from it and see the parallels.
We see in that hearing a black politician saying he thought this was primarily a racial issue, and then went to meet with people in the neighborhood, the people who were complaining about the MOVE house and what their tactics were, and said to his surprise these were ordinary working class African-American people, that this wasn't a racial issue. Yet it is impossible to divorce it from race.
Yeah, I guess what I would say is that I would always argue on the side of complexity. It is absolutely a story about race in America, yet it is not only a story about race in America. And I think sort of the ultimate moral lesson to me about how does the unthinkable come to happen is it is truly any time that we look upon a fellow human and see not a fellow human, but a label. And I think what begins to become very interesting about the story is that the assumption is that label is black. But in fact, it's different than that. And that label is sort of this one-off unique label that only existed for a moment in Philadelphia called MOVE. But in fact, the lesson is that that label could be absolutely anything. It could be race or gender orientation. But the answer to the question, and when I say the unthinkable, I mean they let the fire burn and there were children in the house. And the beginning of that is when we don't see another human being.
And let the fire burn. The idea was to destroy that bunker you talked about on the roof of the house, yet they were willing to let the fire burn and kill everyone else inside.
Kill everyone in the house, including children, and destroy 61 homes. 61 families lost their homes. And we do have to come back to the issue of race because they were predominantly, or I actually believe exclusively, black families.
And one of the updates is that, yes, houses were built for all of those people by the city, yet the construction was so shoddy they all had to be torn down.
That's correct. And there was actually a lawsuit and charges of kickbacks to the contractor and ultimately indictments about that as well. It was truly an ongoing disaster for decades.
An indictment for that, yet no charges filed.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ironies is that there are exactly two people to serve time over this incident. Both are African-American. One is Ramon Africa, who was in the house, is convicted of conspiracy to commit riot. And the other is, in fact, the African-American contractor who's hired by the city to rebuild the homes, which are ultimately condemned.
And there is one figure in the film who, in a an important role, but relatively minor to his later political career, Ed Rendell, then the district attorney, later governor of the state of Pennsylvania.
Yes, I think that's right. For the most part, the people you see have faded away either immediately or a little while later. But you do see an early chapter of Ed Rendell's life. And I haven't heard from Mr. Rendell, but I'll be interested if he sees the film and what he thinks.
It's interesting. He uses he is, as always, blunt spoken.
Yeah, and I mean, in my opinion, in the film, he comes off certainly not as bad as many other people in the film. And in fact, the things that you hear him saying are he does represent a certain rationality, even if he still winds up sort of on the side that perpetrates the atrocities in a lot of ways.
And did not necessarily take responsibility for that.
No, he does not necessarily take responsibility. That's true.
Neither does any. There's this terrible moment where people say, the mayor says, I issued an order to put out the fire. And the head of the police department says, well, wait a minute. Yeah, did I get, well, he's very vague on whether he got the order. And the fire chief says, I never got that order.
Yeah, in the there's some great sort of academic literature on the issue in the communications area, and they would call that a breach, right, where communication broke down and the, whatever system is supposed to be working stopped working and communication stopped. And I think that's an interesting way to look at it. The fire chief ultimately is the only person who, it doesn't appear in the film, but he eventually at a press conference breaks down and apologizes and sort of in an emotional way says it was all my fault. Everyone else issues at best half apologies.
Let the Fire Burn is the name of the documentary. Jason Osder is its director. It played at the AFI Doc's Best of Fest on Monday. The film is an account of the incidents that led up to it during the 1985 standoff between MOVE and Philadelphia authorities. Jason Osder joined us here in Studio 42. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, we expect the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage, Prop 8, and DOMA. Join us for that. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.